Blog Talk Radio.
Golden beaming beauty man, if it's only fantasy. Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe? There are better days to see. So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time of night. Right before
yes, blessed souls, here it comes. This is blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we are the inner higher frequency of blogtalkradio.com. We call ourselves Soul Class. This happens to be Soul Class 580, Secular by Design Program Presentation number 60, and we're alive because we're blessed to stay alive in the Creator's Torah, but Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator, shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live, March 16th, from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA. Unified Soul Actualization is 9:32 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Program content will focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances, which can be purchased via the following link, www.goodread.com/book/show/18126658-secular-by-design. Our call-in number, if you want to participate, make the show a little more organic, is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. And the tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, Alan W. Cecil, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, Meditate to Eliminate Hate, Jealousy, and Competition Not Needed. And being that today's program is the 580th program, Blog Talk Radio, I thought I would spice it up a little bit to give you a little Torah Gematria, the mathematical value of 580 is Shin Pei Resh, which means Shefer, which means goodly and beautiful, which you can learn more about if you understand the Hebrew, or you can learn the Hebrew, and then go and access this word in the book of Genesis, chapter 49, verse 21. But in order to continue on with today's program, we have to request forgiveness from Blessed Brother in Prayer, Spirit, and Soul, and acts of kindness, Rabbi Isaac Paton, the president of Beit Mazal, Sephardic congregation, which is a Shabbat-only congregation, located here in Kesakron Heights at 1433 President Street, located between Albany Avenue and President Street, Kingston Avenue and Albany Avenue, and is under the spiritual direction of Rabbi Rav Daniel Mapur. So without further ado, we're going to turn down the music. And just a reminder, if you happen to attend the Shul of Rabbi Isaac Paton Beit Mazal, which also is run by Reb Yitzhak Fakira and Reb Daniel Yaluz, you'll hear chanting out of authentic Jewish, Sephardic, North African singing, fused together with ancient Hebrew, Israelite, Jewish liturgical wording. Without further ado, we're going to bring on our co-host, Rambam teacher, student, disseminator, and advocate for the spreading of the teachings of the Nesher HaGadol Rambam, my Rav Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Don, and to all our listeners.
Thank you, Dennis. It looks like for now, although I had alerted him last night, that Alan is not going to participate. If he calls in, we'll certainly have him join the festivities. So now, blessed souls, as we turn to this book, this wonderful book called Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. Firstly, I would like to dedicate today's efforts, humble efforts, towards the refuah shlema, complete healing of my father, Reb Shlomo Yaakov Ben Esther, and for the strengthening of spirit and soul and body of my mother, Miras Yiska Bas Chayasar Alei Shalom. So, with that being said, let's turn to today's presentation. We're going to go back a little bit, quoting from The Clash of Civilizations and Remaking of World Order, written by Samuel P. Huntington and published by Simon Schuster back in 1996. Here Alan chose to quote from that book. In fact, Alan is now with us, so let's bring him in.
Good morning. How
are
you doing?
A little tardy, but that's okay. You'll be excused for the fact that I'm sure you were involved in many activities and not of the thumb-twiddling congregation.
I had to make my wife some coffee, so.
Listen, you don't have a life if you don't make coffee for your wife.
That's right.
So, and we have Dennis on board as well, Alan, so I guess you can throw out your shout-out to Dennis and Dennis to Alan.
Morning, Alan.
Morning, Dennis. How you doing?
All right.
Okay. So we're going to start off, we're going to get a running start in the section called The Foolish Consistency, page 115. Alan, to update you, quoting from Huntington's, which you quoted from The Clash of Civilizations, Remaking a World Order. What about Jewish civilization? Most scholars of civilization hardly mention it. In terms of numbers of people, Judaism clearly is not a major civilization. Toynbee describes it as an arrested civilization, which evolved out of the earlier Syriac civilization. It is historically affiliated with both Christianity and Islam, and for several centuries, Jews maintained their cultural identity within Western Orthodox and Islamic civilizations. Now, reading further, and then we'll turn to Dennis and Alan. Alan, Dennis, for feedback. The point of view was similar to Kant's view that only, quote-unquote, only an educated public, which has existed uninterruptedly from its origin to our times, can authenticate ancient history. So here we ask another question. Exactly what was an educated public? To Kant, an educated public meant a public which had been educated in Greek and Roman culture and indoctrinated in Christian theology. This has had a profound impact on our view of history, both in the way it has been dated and the way it was interpreted. A people educated in Talmud and Torah, who have studied the Mishnah and the Gemara, otherwise known as the Talmud as well, and the codes of Maimonides and Rabbi Yosef Cairo, these people were, according to Western scholars, not part of the quote-unquote educated public because, to the Western mind, Rabbinic Judaism and Hebrew language were of little educational value. There was a reason that Jewish scholarship has not been, quote-unquote, such a great milestone in the history of education, end of quote. It was deliberately excluded, and that the, quote-unquote, the history of Talmudic Judaism, since Hebrew philologia has become bound up in one specialism with Old Testament research, not only never obtains separate treatment, but has been completely forgotten by all the major histories of religion. And that's Spengler, quoting from The Decline of the West, Volume 2. Well, my response is, first of all, you know, when we're talking about an uninterrupted history, I beg to differ with Mr. Spengler. We of the Nation of Israel, even before we were the Nation of Israel, have an uninterrupted history, and it's ancient, and has been authenticated and documented. And not only that, that of the children of Noah has been documented. So why Spengler, in his viewpoint similar to Kant, wants to promote the supremacy of Greek and Roman culture and fused with Christian theology to the exclusion of that which was prior to it, to me in itself is a little bit strange, you know, reading that as a Jew. And I also want to mention, because we're in proximity about 1 week away, 8 days away from the Jewish holiday of Purim. The fact of the matter is that Ahasuerus, who was the king of Persia, then the most powerful empire, was actually making his celebrated feast, which you could read in chapter 1 of the book of Esther, based on the fact that he was celebrating the fact that he perceived, and the Jewish people were in agreement, which led to the decree against them, where they were almost annihilated by the hands of the wicked Haman's designs, that the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah, the 70 years had passed, he had miscalculated, and his sages had miscalculated, and the gullible Jews in living in the Persian Empire also fell for it. So therefore, there was some reverence for Jewish history and tradition held by the most powerful men in the ancient Persian Empire. And the fact that Haman, when he cast lots, found out that the lot would fall out for the decree to annihilate the Jews in one day, would fall out in Adar, he also knew that was the same month that the prophet Moses passed away. So the ancient peoples of the Middle East, or if you want to call it the Avant, or the Levant, or Middle Asia, whatever you want to call it, or Asia Minor, they seem to have held it in esteem. It just seemed that when the European influence became the predominant culture and its subsequent spin-offs to this time, there's been a forgetting of the fact that ancient cultures, such as the ancient Persian Empire, had some sort of reverence for Jewish history and even Jewish prophecy. Alan?
Well, it's obvious that Huntington read the same kind of scholarship that Toynbee and Spengler and others had studied, basically scholars who ignored Israel's history. Going back to the first part of the chapter, yeah, you're absolutely right that Israel had an uninterrupted history, not to mention that the church kept alive Israel's history when Greek and Roman history was forgotten. So why they can say that Israel did not have a continuous history, and ignoring the fact that Greek and Roman history was ignored and forgotten for centuries, it just shows the bias of these scholars in their anti-Israel, anti-Jewish attitude.
Dennis?
Christianity has never refuted Judaism, but if you're a big-time professor from a big-time academic school and you decide to write a highly opinionated of history that occurred centuries and centuries before, who is going to refute it? I mean, the man in the street can't say anything about it because this is a big-time school that's backing the big-time professor. So here we have what is being laid down as the unabridged truth, so to speak, which is really an opinion piece. But we say, oh, well, it was done by a trusted official at this school, and he spent years and years doing this. Well, that doesn't make it any truer, but people seem to just accept it. And this has been done over and over and over through the ages. So here we are questioning something that people have already gotten high acclaim, awards, and all the honors that can be perceived from here to kingdom come, and we're saying that it's still his opinion or the writer's opinion. Yet, we bring up the fact that who has refuted Judaism? Nobody has. They've basically ignored it. What we don't understand is why they ignored it.
Thank you, Dennis.
May I add
further
one more point?
Sure.
Huntington's premise was that it was a cultural rather than a political problem that is going on in the world right now. And when you have over 2 billion Christians or people living in Christian countries and 2 billion Muslims, just to think that those two cultures were not influenced by Jewish history is absurd.
Well, numbers don't obviate the truth.
Well, I just want to mention there's a mathematician. He lives up in, I believe, Boston, Massachusetts. His name is Sam Tenen. He's a very brilliant man. And he once made a comment on national radio that we should consider the Judaic faith the seed, Christianity the tree, and Islam, or the Muslim faith, the fruit. Now, it is not befitting for the fruit or the tree to deny they came from the seed. Because if they do, they're invalidating their own existence. I just want to add, that's from Stan Tenen, a mathematician who I want to say that.
I think
that
it's more like that Jewish history is the roots that it's all based on.
Well, I agree, but I mean, the seed is planted.
Either way, you're recognizing the source.
Yeah. Going further into Alan's book, Thucydides wrote, the historian of the Peloponnesian War during the middle of the 5th century before the Common Era. Yet the Tanakh was written long before that, such as the Torah, the five books of Moses, the prophets, also known as the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, which is basically the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs and Psalms. Ancient Greece had a tremendous impact on history. Was it truly greater than Israel's impact? As Alan continued to write, when Adam Smith said that there's nothing written in Hebrew of any esteem other than the Holy Scriptures, one wonders how he can ignore works such as the Mishnah or the Gemara. What books of esteem did the Greeks produce in the early centuries before the Common Era that could rival the Talmud? With that being said, I want to jump in and I want to share something from the Talmud, which basically most people won't know unless they learn it. It's in the Tractate Nedarim, which is basically the oral Torah tradition of how it is that a human being can take vows. And this is calling from the 8th page, the second side. It's a very terse teaching, which gives a little illumination of how far ahead of their times the sages were in terms of the oral Torah tradition and understanding what we can gain out of the sun's rays. Rav Chanina said in the Rav Miashia, who had it from the tradition, Rav Yehuda ben Bar Eloi, what is the meaning of the verse? And here we're quoting from the prophet Malachi, or Malachi, chapter 3, verse 20, but a sun of righteousness will shine for you who fear my name with healing in its rays. This refers to people who fear to utter God's name in vain. As it says in the verse, a sun of righteousness with healing in its rays. So Baye said, one of the great Talmudic sages said, we can infer from this that the sun rays have a healing power. Now, Abaye did not conduct any clinical study. He basically used his powers of observation based and fused with the oral Torah tradition. And today, I know, I spoke a couple years ago with a top-flight psychiatrist in New York City because I'm in social services and I deal with psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists. And he said that he has found that with his patients who are prone to depression, whether they're of the bipolar spectrum or not, that getting about 40 to 45 minutes a day of sunlight not only helps their mood, it also can generate higher levels of vitamin D. So for those who feel a little skittish about drinking milk or worried about the GMO factor involved in milk or the additives, which some people are decrying as having deleterious effects on the body, the sun's rays, as testified by the sage Abaye, have already been indicated to have a healing power, and that was before any scientific study was done on it, and that's a teaching from about 1500, 1600, 1700 years ago. And yet, the assertion is that, you know, was there anything of worth coming out of the written scripture? And here we see we quoted Malachi, and the Talmudic teaching right there is showing us way back when the ancient peoples, the Jews of those days, in relation to our time, knew that getting sunlight. And no one's advocating one overdoes the sunlight and becomes sun worshippers to the point where they burn their skin. So the value health wise, which can be gained out of learning certain snippets from the Torah, benefits all of mankind, not just the Jewish people. Alan?
Well, he seems like a pretty bright fellow. I guess I don't know about the understanding of vitamin D and stuff. I mean, I agree with that completely. Of course, back in those days, you know, most people worked outdoors, so they didn't have a problem with that. Today, everybody's locked up in a little office cubicle. They go home in their car. People do not get outside as much.
Dennis?
Yes, our forefathers were not stupid people. They did have common sense. And in some cases, it was elevated common sense. They didn't know the technical explanation, but they observed. And based on observance, they said, well, wait a minute. This looks like this is better than it is bad for you. Just like in the dietary laws, they were watching people who were dying from eating uncured pork. They were watching people die who were eating shellfish. They didn't know why, but there was certain shellfish that some people didn't live too long. So they said, maybe it's better off to stay away. So they didn't know the scientific meaning, but they sure knew some common sense. So we got to give these people credit for using human common sense.
Thank you, Dennis. Let's go further. In Allen's book, Kant said that, quote-unquote, only an educated public which has existed uninterruptedly from its origin to our times can authenticate ancient history, end of quote. Yet what ancient people were more educated than the Jews, and what determining factor was there in what is considered, quote-unquote, authenticated history? I just want to mention briefly that, listen, we certainly were educated, but that doesn't diminish the fact that other peoples were in fact educated, because we have to understand, what are the standards for education? Is it just that I should be able to do an algebraic problem or quantum physics? Or is it that I am being educated how to continue the community that I'm a part of, how to continue the civilization I'm a part of, how to continue the world that I am a part of? So I just want to make a comment tangentially to that comment, that there were other educated people from ancient days, because civilizations were going from one step to another step in terms of ascending towards ultimately, hopefully, an era where all of us can truly say of the human film experience will all be educated. So I just want to continue before turning to Alan and Dennis, for more feedback. Why are the Jews who were spread out among the civilized nations of the Middle East considered, quote-unquote, isolated? Why would Jewish reports be met with less belief than the Greek reports? Are the stories in Genesis and Exodus less believable than the stories of God's magic and monsters found in the Iliad and the Odyssey? Why would Jewish stories only be taken seriously after they were translated in the Greek Septuagint? How can one dismiss the Talmud, the Midrash, and writings of Rashi, Nachmanides, Harav, Shimshon, Raphael, Hirsch, and countless others? To ignore the influence of the Jewish people, a people that has been involved in the history and culture of the West from the dawn of Western civilization, does not seem logical. But Alan, it doesn't seem that it was logic that these Western replacement consciousness educators were seeking as much as they had an agenda. Your take on these matters? Alan? Sounds like we lost Alan. Dennis?
Yes, what happens is education is a large, large umbrella. Now, if you're going to place education of learning about human things is one thing. If you're going to place education on God's things and everything about God, that's another separation. However, to say that if you're learning about God, you're not really being educated because you should be learning about human things, well, I got news for a lot of people. Learning about God is educational. Learning about humans, it is. But here we get back to which has the deeper and the larger vista of education. I'm not going to answer that question. You can answer that yourself just using human common sense. So who has more to offer, the human being or God?
Alan, are you there? Alan, are you there? I guess he muted his phone, so hopefully he'll join us. I just want to mention as well that when we talk about learning about God in a way that a human mind can understand, we're talking about understanding there is something profound, more profound than any perception of a human being. But when we perceive things which seem quite profound, that which we can elucidate upon, it provides a structure, provides a framework of the environment that we're living in, and hopefully that it will help us to improve our environment. With that being said, going further on, and hopefully Alan will call us back, yet logic did not play a part in this attempt to belittle the learning and knowledge of a people that has done much to shape the history of the world. The Greek language has no intrinsic superiority. Oh, I think we just brought, let's bring back Alan. Alan, you back?
Hello.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
So, yeah. So we were just mentioning Dennis Compton, I Compton, the idea that the conclusions that were used to ignore the influence of Jewish people, who we basically have been involved in the beginning, we were engaged in the dawn of Western civilization, that seemed logical. It doesn't seem that logical was the dictum that these replacement consciousness educators would have us, lead us to believe that they were using logic in forming their ideas.
Well, it's like what you had said before about there is a lot of knowledge in the nations, but so much of it is what the Perkei Avot says are the condiments of wisdom, not the meat and potatoes. And that is, you know, that is one of the main problems. You know, we're feeding ourselves in our academic pursuits condiments, you know, dining on ketchup and mustard instead of the meat and potatoes of knowledge.
Right. I guess some people would fall for that because I think during the Reagan administration, ketchup was considered as a vegetable. So I guess some people would want to load up on their veggies by having a, you know, a cup of ketchup.
There you go.
Yeah. Yet logic did not play a part in this attempt to belittle the learning and knowledge of a people that has done so much to shape the history of the world. The Greek language has no intrinsic superiority over Hebrew, nor do Greek ethics have any predominance over Jewish ethics. The reasons for the Greek derision towards anything Jewish have more to do with theology than reason or historical truth. Systems of Christian theology and Christian thought directly affect our view of history, and to the untrained eye, often in subtle and imperceptible ways. And that's where Alan quotes from Mark T. Gilderhus' History and Historians' Historiographical Introduction, which is published by Prentice Hall in 2003, quoting from page 14, as we will in a moment. The Jews also wrote about their history. In fact, they wrote about it long before the Greeks wrote about theirs, a fact not lost on some historians, such as Mark T. Gilderhus, who he just quoted as a source for that statement. And here it goes. The Jews of ancient history developed a very different outlook. For them, history became more important than for any other ancient people. Hebrew historical writing was more the product of religious experience and faith than a manifestation of critical or rational inquiry. Well, I have to laugh at that one. The Jews interpreted the events in the lives of the people according to intense convictions. Bias and inconsistency, be sure, crept into their narratives. For example, Jewish writers sometimes incorporate different versions of the same events from diverse oral traditions. Nevertheless, they also displayed a capacity for hard-headed objectivity.
Okay. Ooh,
at first he threw me off, but I guess in the end, Mr. Gilderhus is saying that Jews are human beings too. Sometimes they can integrate their convictions, integrate their faith, and sometimes that they are going back on their experiences from their theological background. At the same time, too, they can also have a capacity for hard-headed objectivity, which any person can have. So that really doesn't distinguish us. So I don't really take offense to what he's saying, Mr. Gilderhus. But I do want to mention, I misquoted before when I said footnote 5, quoting Gilderhus. That was actually footnote 6. I do want to quote from Toynbee's A Study of History, then I'll turn to Alan and Dennis. Dennis and Alan for feedback. The European Greeks who allowed themselves to feel superior to the Asiatic Greek contemporaries 5th century were at that time free from the fanatical Judaic hallucination of being a chosen people. So after you two respond, I'd like to redefine or make it known. What does it mean to be chosen? Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, we have a human problem here that just keeps showing itself over and over. Education is good, but if you get enough education, Are you building an ego? Unfortunately, some people think, because they're educated, that they're superior to other people. In effect, we were all human still in God's eyes. So to think that some people have a higher level of humanity because they're educated, well, that's sort of ego building again. So we have to be careful of how we apply and feed our egos, because we must take everything into account, not our personal viewpoint.
Alan?
Well, when it comes to objectivity, I go into that subject a bit more in Chapter 4, but you know, to sit there and think that people like Toynbee were not biased against Israel is a bit of a joke. And I have never seen any kind of bias in Jewish writings as I have in Western writings when dealing with Israel.
So, and I want to mention this whole idea that, quoting from Toynbee, and remember, we mentioned a couple programs ago, Blessed Souls, that Toynbee actually met Hitler and was actually got some sort of positive impression from meeting him, and had once been a pro-Zionist during the early days of the Zionist movement. And I just want to clarify, I am not a Zionist. I'm not a pro-Zionist. I'm pro-Jewish. I allow for certain flexibility towards other Jewish people, and that, for that matter, Gentiles, B'nai Noach, to have opinions very different than my own. This whole idea of we having a fanatical Judaic hallucination. Okay, let me elucidate just for a moment how fanatic my Judaic hallucination is as being a member of the chosen people. We were chosen as the nation of Israel, as the 12 tribes of Israel, to learn the Torah, to fulfill the commandments, and to explain those teachings which are relevant to the nations of the world. What are the Creator's expectations for stabilizing the world and making it a peaceful and pleasant abode, including, which is probably one of the hardest endeavors there can be, to educate the nations that they must stop making war one with the other. And fortunately, after the last 4 or 5 years, with more than 250,000 Syrians flying down in a trail of blood and all the suffering in the Ukraine and different parts of the world and in Israel and in Egypt and in Iran, it's a very hard job. So that's what I hallucinate, Blessed Souls, as being a fanatical Jew about being called one of the Chosen People, to spread God's word, and hopefully that it will spread into the hearts and minds and actions of other people. Gentlemen, what do you think of my hallucination? Dennis?
Well, whatever you're drinking or eating, maybe I should have some of that, Don, because it can spread. And it can spread because everybody can use their imagination. And when you use your imagination, you're developing something that you never had before. You're creating things. So the whole idea of education, whether you're going to educate yourself or your neighbor or anybody else, is to get them to use their imagination on the things we know as humans and to associate it with the spiritual world at the same time. That's a perfect formula that everybody should be practicing.
Thank you, Dennis. Alan, what do you think of my fanatical hallucination as being part of the quote-unquote chosen people?
Well, you have to understand that Toynbee's statement about Jewish hallucinations is a theological statement. This is based on the Christian idea that because the Jews rejected Jesus, that all the blessings were given to the church, you know, that had been given to the Jews, and the Jews are no longer the chosen people. That's the problem. If you read Toynbee, you understand that he was, you know, very much a product of Christian culture.
So he is a full-fledged disciple of replacement theology.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is the basis of his comment about Jewish hallucinations. Oh, they're not the chosen people anymore. The Christians are.
Well, I say every human being has been chosen to be blessed and not to be stressed with the understanding, as testified in Genesis chapter 1:27, that he or she, whoever you may be, has been appointed and anointed, and you shouldn't be disappointed to know you have a divine image. With that being said, blessed souls, we're going to conclude today's program. First, I want to thank Alan W. Cecil, the author of this wondrous book called Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, where he's basically deconstructing the negative aspects, because not all aspects of Western civilizational thought have been negative, but those parts which have caused damage and are creating, unfortunately, the byproducts of some of the problems we have in today's society, just as historically there have been efforts amongst the Jewish people, the leaders, the righteous ones, to deconstruct ill-thinking Jewish ideas which tried to creep into the mainstream of normative, quote-unquote, Judaism, which is kind of a paradoxical statement unto itself, because normative is really that which is in-the-moment type of Judaic observances. Anyway, I want to thank you, Alan and Dennis. Alan, any last word you'd like to share with our audience before we segue out of today's program with David Dohm's It's Enough?
Well, if you want to be healthy, go light on the condiments and eat solid food.
Dennis?
Yes, the easiest thing that humans can do is blame. Point fingers, blame, etc. That way, it doesn't point at you, and you're not a part of it, because you're saying it's someone else's problem. However, he who has no sin should not condemn other people.
Okay. And with that being said, we want to remind everyone that we all have to do good. We are empowered to do good. Even if that entails us coming to realize that we might have done something wrong in the past. We have to rectify matters between ourselves and Creator and with other people. But that's okay. The Creator is a tevatov lehetiv. The nature of the good to do is to do good. And one of the things that we can identify as something which is good in a tangible, experiential way is the fact He created you, blessed soul, or blessed souls. And therefore that empowers you to go out and do something good today to stabilize the creation on the most mundane microcosmic level. Don't be surprised if there happens to be a butterfly effect of goodness in your immediate and greater environment by the very act that you engaged in, whether it be an act of thinking properly, an act of speaking properly, an act of actually extending some aspect of your physical body and physical presence to assist someone in some matter, as mundane as a good morning, sir, good morning, ma'am, helping that proverbial old lady or old man across the street, or perhaps lending someone a dollar so they can get that cup of coffee to help them get through that part of the day. It's that simple, yet it's that profound. You have to make the choice if you're going to do it or not, and then see how you feel after doing something good. That being said, we're going to end off right now, hopefully in a way of Ahava Chad, one love, Gor Lecha, one destiny, Kulanu, for all of us, B'dachi Nom, B'dachi Shalom, in a pleasant and peaceful way. And it's enough. And that happens to be the name of our segue ending show song by David Dohm. Take care, everyone. Right.